So then I go to pull my ball marker out of my pocket, and I had this pair of pants on that had the pocket inside the pocket. It was stuck. It was jammed. So now I stick my middle finger in there, and I grab it, and I'm so mad, I just ripped it as hard as I could. Tees, coins, everywhere went flying all over the green, and I ripped my pants from my pocket all the way down to my knee. So now my knee and underwear are hanging out. Sergio Garcia's on the ground laughing, but it was the hardest I've ever seen him laugh. So I two-putt, tap in for the smooth nine, and then I just decided to rip my pants the rest of the way. So now, basically, I'm walking with my pants ripped from my pocket on my right leg all the way down to my shoe, with my leg hanging out, and they just kept laughing at me all day. So that was probably my last time playing that hole.
Oh, man, that's classic.
And this is Will Wilcox.
There you go. There you go. Yes!
Jim Renner on the 15th hole. His third shot, you bet.
Welcome to episode 6 of the Tier Time Podcast with Jim Renner and myself, Willie Wilcox. We got a special guest this week in Mark Calcavecchia, champion golfer of the year of 89. Amongst many, many other accomplishments. And it's just an absolute pleasure to have him on. So, Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure, Willie. Jim, thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. So this whole thing, you know, we just want to, you know, do the broad strokes of your career and the three decades that you spent on the PGA Tour. I mean, you're from Nebraska, moved to Florida at 13, right? And did you relocate because of golf?
No, actually, I grew up in a small town in Northeast Nebraska, about 920 people. And, we had a little 9-hole course that my dad and, two of his buddies kind of designed. They basically bought a 43-acre cornfield right outside of town. Because back then, you know, driving 15 or 20 minutes to the next town over to play golf was, you know, way too far to go. So anyway, it was just a field. And that's where I learned how to basically hit it. And we moved to North Palm Beach in 1973 when I was 13, mainly for my father's health reasons. He had multiple sclerosis.
Okay.
And the winter of 72, he slipped on the ice and messed up his arm and his shoulder, and he said that's the last winter we're spending here, and off went to South Florida.
Well, that worked out great for your golf career. That couldn't, I mean under the circumstances, obviously not ideal, but I mean you got to end up in, you know, kind of the golf mecca. So
yeah, it took me a little bit to get used to it, but when I played tennis and golf with my older brother on Christmas morning, I kind of realized it was a pretty cool place to be when I called my friends at home, and it was the wind chill was 25 below, and there was a blizzard going on. So I'm like, yeah, this South Florida gig, it's pretty sweet.
Yeah, it's amazing. I miss Jupiter for sure. This Alabama winter, I just spent the first time in 14 years. I mean, it's like the worse the weather is here in Nebraska, the better it is down there, is what I've noticed.
And that was the thing. I mean, Mark, like I grew up in Massachusetts as a kid, and you know, dealt with some pretty hard winters. And my grandparents had a place in Boynton Beach, and we'd go down there during the winter, you know, as a young kid. And I remember being like, why can't we just live here all the time? What is, you know, it's
all right.
It's January and it's absolutely gorgeous. We're at the beach. Why can't we live here? Instead, we go back and it's freezing. So that had to have been a pretty nice change from Nebraska, you know, to Florida, especially for golf. And then, you know, obviously for your father's health reasons, that's a good thing. But, you know, how about tell us a little bit about what it was like going to high school in Palm Beach, and, you know, you're in that golf mecca, and one of the people that you got to become good friends with was Jack Nicklaus' son, Jackie.
Yeah, no, it was definitely a shock. It took me a little bit for sure to get used to it, especially golf-wise. I mean, I could hit it pretty good, but I literally had no idea how to curve it around trees or play out of bunkers or deal with any of the stuff that you have to deal with on a real golf course. The little 9-holer that I grew up on had no trees, no water, no bunkers, no irrigation, no nothing. It was just literally with little round greens and that were irrigated in the tees. So when I first got down here, I chipped out every bunker. Luckily at North Palm Beach Country Club, there weren't really any big lips, so I could get away with that. But then, I had to learn how to play out of bunkers. I had to learn how to hook it around trees and slice it around trees and blah, blah, blah. And so it was obviously great for my golf game. And I got here in July of 1973, and probably a month later, in a Palm Beach County Junior Golf Association event, I met Jack Nicklaus Jr., Jackie. So, and we played together, and we were exactly the same age. So I got here in eighth grade. So we played high school golf for 4 years against each other. To my recollection, I don't think he ever beat me, but he might have once. But anyway, Big Jack showed up at a lot of our matches, and it was really amazing to, come from a little small town in Nebraska to having the greatest golfer of all time watch you playing golf against his son. And he was nothing but great to me always. So yeah. Definitely my golf idol for sure.
So your formative years of growing up playing golf involved the Golden Bear. I mean, like, were there lessons? Did he give you pointers? I mean, did y'all have, did you go to sleepovers at the Nicklaus's home type thing? Or, I mean, like, how involved was Jack and you guys' development?
No, I never took lessons from him or asked advice. He was just always very supportive. Nice. And really only saw him when I was playing golf with Jackie, or at a high school event. Maybe even if I wasn't playing with Jackie, Mr. Nicklaus would show up and hang out and kind of watch the matches. And I thought it was really cool that he would do that. And of course, if my son was in the same boat, I'd probably do the same thing. But again, he was just nothing but very complimentary to me, and gave me a lot of confidence actually.
Nice. So just played like a bunch of South Florida junior tours, and that's where you met him.
Yep. And high school golf. Yep. And plus he lived in Lost Tree Village, which he still does. He's had the same house for 50 some years. I think he moved there in the late 60s, and I got to North Palm Beach in 73. So I was literally a mile and a half right up Highway 1 from where they lived. So we were very close.
Wow, that's cool. There's just so many pros. It's just so saturated now down there. I know Orlando's kind of the spot for a lot of pros for many years, but it just seems like everybody's clamoring for the Jupe life now. And obviously you grew up there basically. So, I mean, it was a no brainer for you. I feel like Steve Marino was a big influence in people moving to the Palm Beach area that were on tour. I don't know. Seems like one of the originals.
Well, you were down here for a while. I mean, I get that all the time in pro-amps and stuff. And, where are you from? I said, I grew up in Nebraska, but I live in Jupiter, Florida. Oh, you live where Tiger lives, and you live where Ricky lives, and Dustin and JT.
He lives where you live.
No, they live where I live.
Yeah, exactly. You were there well before them.
I've been there almost, 49 years now. So, Yeah, they live where I live. That's 100% correct.
I like that.
Couch started the Jupe life, damn it. So you went to North Shore High School, right?
Yeah.
And was high school golf very organized back then? Like, I didn't even play my last 2 years because I was more concerned to like getting the U.S. Junior, playing AJGAs and Southeastern Junior Golf Tours and stuff. Like, did the high school golf ranks matter back then, or how was that structured?
Yeah. It did. It wasn't, hugely popular like it is now, or the kids now in high schools have practice facilities at the courses they have, much like college. When I went to the University of Florida, I mean, we had a little tin locker and that was it. And crap range balls and a crap range. Now all these schools have hitting bays and video machines and workout centers, and it's entirely different now than it was of course, well, already 47 yes. 48 years ago, but it was still important. And when I won the Junior Orange Bowl in 77, that really kind of put me on the map with colleges, and from that point on I had a lot of them trying to get a hold of me and want me to come play play college golf at their schools.
That was definitely something I wanted to ask you about. Renner, did you ever play in that the Orange Bowl?
We've been playing. I never played in the Orange Bowl, but I played in the Doral Publix, which I'm not sure if that was around back then. But I mean, kind of the point Cal said, it's just, you know, when you played in some of those events, if you played really well, man, you became like on the radar of a lot of people. So I'm sure, you know, when you were playing in those events, you knew like, if I play well here, then, you know, you start getting all that interest. Everyone wants you. And then next time you're at University of Florida. And I mean, was there many other choices that you made, or do you kind of always want to be a Gator? Because I feel like every UF person just loves them Florida Gators. So it's, you know.
Yeah.
Was that always the number one choice, or was that maybe something that you thought about maybe going somewhere else?
Well, believe it or not, you know, being in high school, I wasn't really into the Florida State rivalry type thing. And I went to visit both places, and I had friends at Florida. Tallahassee was 2.5 hours for the drive away, and I didn't really like their course as much as the course at Florida. The course at Florida at the time was called University Golf Club, and it was it's a Donald Ross course. It had little
tough track, right? Tight.
Yeah, it's tight, tree lined, had little tiny kind of round upside down greens. And it was great for me. It was great for my short game. And that's why I chose Florida. I just thought the course was better for me and I could become a better player there. But those were my really only two choices that I thought about, was either Florida or Florida State.
Some pretty good options.
Yeah, and I feel like what you said right there, I think, is a pretty good point. Is, you know, you took your, you know, you looked at Florida State, and then you looked at Florida, and obviously you fell in love with the course, and you felt like this was a place that would make you better. And you know, and you looked at it from just the short game, the golf course, and everything. And I feel like sometimes, you know, some people just want to go to the school that's maybe the best, whatever. Party school or the best school or whatever, but you really want to be about like golf. Like you look at what they have there and you know, what can make you better. So that's pretty cool. Like to be at that age and you knew you wanted to be a professional golfer, I'm sure at that point, or at least that it was in the cards.
Yeah, I did. The year after we got here, in July of 73. So in February of 74, my older brother took me down to the Jackie Gleason Inverary Classic at Inverary. And obviously the first pro tournament I've ever been to, ever seen. And my mouth was on the ground the whole day. My jaw was wide open. And I knew that day that was what I was going to do for my career, that I was going to be a professional golfer. And there was never any looking back from it from that day on. And of course, I mean, I watched Jack. I watched him in 76 when he birdied the last five holes against Greer Jones. I was there in the gallery watching every bit of that. And anyway, so yeah, just every year I went down to Doral and Inverary. And just each time I went, I got more and more and more excited about being a professional golfer.
The Jackie Gleason Jr. So he put his name on a junior event, the comedian. I mean, that's kind of a trip. I mean, that's funny. Like, I mean,
it was called the Jackie Gleason Inverary Classic. It was a PGA Tour event. I don't think there was ever a junior tournament there, but
you're saying you were just checking it out. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just a kid. And that's what I knew when I was, 14 or 15 years old, that's what I was going to do.
Yeah, it's all big business now. You don't get those, you know, events, right? You know, like the Bob Hope, none of that, you know, kind of gotten away from all that. You know, obviously the Justin Timberlake Shriners, but I mean, you just don't have celebrities tying their names to events anymore because everything's just so, you know, blue chip sponsored.
Right.
Well, that's cool. So you put all your eggs in one basket and headed up to Florida. Like, were your grades decent when you went to school, or were you just a grinder on the course?
Well, that was a big shock because I thought I was a genius in high school. growing up in Nebraska, you know, very good schools, obviously. When I got down here in eighth grade, they were teaching stuff at the let it be said, I grew up in a town of 920 people. There were 1,300 kids in my eighth grade class.
Wow.
So anyway, that was a shock to the system right off the bat. And then I discovered that they were teaching stuff in eighth grade in South Florida that I learned in fifth grade in Nebraska. So went to a public high school as well, North Shore. Never studied one day in my life and was on the Honor Society. I mean, I thought I was pretty smart, but
yeah, you're just so ahead of the game.
Yeah, I was my first 13 years. I mean, like I said, I learned a lot and thought I was a pretty smart kid. Then I got to college, and my first semester, I got two C's and two D's, and the coach started yelling at me and said, you better study a little harder, blah, blah, blah. So it was a college was a wake up call. I remember taking 2 years of Spanish in high school and accounting. And I thought I was going to be an accountant if I didn't turn out great in pro golf. And I thought I was pretty smooth in Spanish. I dropped Spanish after 5 days because I had no clue what the hell was going on. And I dropped accounting after 2 weeks because I was completely lost. So, yeah, welcome to college.
Yeah.
A little different story.
Yeah, it's nice that you can drop courses and just pull the chute and you're like, right? Okay, this is over my head.
Exactly. Yeah, that was me. So anyway, I stayed eligible for 2.5 years. That's kind of how I ended up turning pro.
Really?
Long story short, we had a 6-round qualifier for the last two fall tournaments my junior year in the fall of 80. A 6-round qualifier, I averaged 64.5. I won the qualifier by 14 shots. Nice. On a 6-round qualifier. And my coach didn't take me to the last two fall events. And he told me, he says, you need to stay in town and catch up on your grades because they're a little iffy. And he was worried about me not being eligible for the spring. So, of course, I said, coach, I don't go to class whether I'm in town or out of town. And I'm by far your best player. So if you want to win these tournaments, you better take me. I said, Calc, I don't like your attitude. Blah, blah, blah. So that was the end of that. And then, of course, I called him January 3rd or whatever and said, I just entered the first series of the J.C. Goosey Mini Tour in Orlando. See ya. And that was it. And I turned pro. So that was college.
That's an incredible exit. I love that. I mean, that's like stuff I'm sure people on the golf team you played with talk about. They're like, oh, one day Calc was here and then he wins the qualifier and the coach tells him not play. And then next thing you know, he's like playing in a pro tournament in Orlando the next week.
That's exactly what happened.
Coaches, man, they can be your worst enemy so quickly with their decisions. I mean, they're just glorified bus drivers for the most part. I mean, I know there are good coaches out there, but when they make a big decision like that and sour the attitude of the number one player, that was a good call to just fail out.
And back then they weren't teachers. We didn't have a regime where like one day we had to spend 2 hours at the chipping green and the bunker and then go work out like they do now. I know I've heard stories now where, I mean, if they're not in class, they have to be either working out, chipping, putting, hitting bunker shots or hitting balls or doing whatever. I mean, we had no schedule. So it was just time to go.
Yeah. It was just all up to you to cultivate your talent. You know, they weren't forcing you. And so no 5 a.m. workouts, none of that crap.
No, none of that. No, absolutely not.
Nice. I did notice that you were only in school for, now you just said 2.5 years. I was thinking it was 3, and I just assume you turned pro just because you were striping it. Obviously you did. You won that qualifier, average 64 and change. But yeah, I mean, obviously you were hot as a pistol, and I mean, there's no reason to not go ahead and sign up for some, you know, legalized gambling, basically, mini tour events.
Mini tour stuff. My first mini tour event, when you first turn pro, JC Goosey put you in the first group, which was fine at 7:30. The only problem was it was at Poinciana in Orlando. And that particular day it was 37 degrees and the wind was blowing 25 miles an hour. And I kind of immediately rethought my decision. I was like,
cold prison.
Oh, it still to this day might be the coldest I've ever been on a golf course. That my first round was a pro. But I ended up making a check that week somehow, and I was off and running. And then that was the last year they had two tour schools, and they had one at Disney World, which I played, you know, a bunch. as a junior and in many tour events. And I was at the Palm course and made it through the first two stages, no problem. And then made it through the final stage. And then all of a sudden in the July of 81, all of a sudden I was on the PGA Tour. So it happened fast.
That's so cool.
Good thing you weren't as good at accounting and Spanish as you thought you were, then, right?
No kidding. Turns out I was awful at both. I thought I was pretty good too.
That's awesome, though, especially like how that happened. And then you go right out there and you get it done, you know, and I feel like that's a tough thing, especially with people who have to do the old Q school where you know what you're playing for at that point in time. But kudos to you for doing that right away, especially how you did it. That's awesome. I mean,
yeah, getting through your first Q school is such a big deal. Like, and the tour was structured differently back then, right? Like, didn't when you got your card at Q school, didn't that just allow you to get into the Monday qualifiers and there was a lot more spots or something like, or did you get straight into events?
No, exactly. 82 was the last year of the Monday qualifiers. So, I was in every Monday, but you had to, you know, Monday to get in. So the start of 82, I jumped in my Camaro Rally Sport, drove from North Palm Beach to Phoenix, to San Diego, to LA, to back to San Diego, wherever, Pebble Beach. Anyway, I drove all the way out to the West Coast and never made a Monday qualifier. And as it turns out, the Monday qualifier for the Hawaiian Open was at Old Del Monte in Monterey, which is kind of a little dumpy, short, quirky course. Mm-hmm. Me, Ken Green, Bob Boyd, and I think Rick Borg, Bill Sander, we played golf every day out there. And when I went to register, turns out I forgot to commit. Basically, I was so pissed off. Basically, I drove nonstop from Pebble Beach to Palm Beach in 48 hours.
Ripping the wheel, cramped Camaro. Yeah.
The good old days of Monday qualifiers. But then finally I made one at the Honda, made a Monday qualifier at the Honda. And back then, if you made the cut, you were in the next tournament. So I made six straight cuts. So I got in six straight tournaments, which was nice. But still, you know, didn't hardly make any money. But yeah, the first 4 or 5 years were interesting, needless to say.
But you did keep your card through 85, right? You were top 125.
Every you know, it was weird. The years I finished between and the next year in 83 was the first year of the all-exempt tour. So when I finished between 125 and 150, I missed tour school. And then the next year, I missed the top 150, but I made it through tour school. So every year from 81 through 85, I had a card where I was going to play at least 20 events. Yeah. And then actually at starting the end of 85, I blew out my knee in Pensacola, playing football on the beach. Right.
I was thinking
figure I might've been a little vodka involved, but anyway, tried to play the finals at tour school in 85 with just after a week and a half of having knee surgery and obviously didn't make it. So started 86 with no status, but was really,
that was your come out party.
It was. I was really starting to play well. I started working with Peter Costas in the middle of 84 and was really starting to figure it out. And anyway, I won a tournament. I won a playoff over Keith Fairwater in Myrtle Beach at what then was called the TPS Tour, which was my biggest check ever, 17 grand. I thought it was loaded.
Oh,
was playing great. Monday qualified for Doral and Honda. Did well there. I made the cuts. Anyway, Ted May gave me an exemption into, or I qualified for the U.S. Open at Shinnecock in 86. Shot 65 the last round, which at that time got me into the top 16, which then got you into the Masters. So I was going to play in the 87 Masters at that time with zero status, which very rarely happens.
So rare. Peterson, I think, was the last one.
Right. Then Ted May gave me an exemption to Hartford top 10, Boston top 10, Milwaukee top 10. And then I won the Southwest Classic the next week in Abilene, Texas.
Abilene, Texas.
Never lost my card again after that.
Wow, what a run you had right there.
Right?
I mean, crazy. Especially like when you know, like your back's against the wall a little bit there. And then you just kept like plugging along and had a hell of a few weeks there. That's awesome.
So you started 86 with no status. That's what you just said.
Started 86 with no status and really didn't have status till September of 87. And then, or September of 86 when I won. And then a year later, virtually to the month, I'm sitting in Jack Nicklaus's and Barbara Nicklaus's house at Muirfield Village as a Ryder Cup player. So, yeah.
And I love that. And I love that you teed it up at Q school, though, back to what you said, that you teed up at Q school a week after having knee surgery.
Was it your left knee or right?
My left knee. So I had to set up with my left foot dead sideways to take the press off the inside of my meniscus. If you can picture that. So it was almost like a take it back and then walk through, follow through, because I couldn't put any stress on the inside of my left knee.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah. I gave it a try.
You turn into kind of a bent knee, right? Like you don't straighten your left knee through impact. So, I mean, right?
Not
like
as much as I should. That's a good point. And I'm going to try that tomorrow, because one of my bad habits is sliding, sagging and sliding, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean. Oh, or straightening my right knee and right hip to take the pressure off my back. And then on the downswing, I just kind of sag and slide, much like Tom Lehman, although he kind of flips it with his hands and hits a draw every time. But ideally, I need to clear my left side and straighten my left leg a little bit more to make sure I don't hit a left. And that's what Peter Kostas and I really worked on in the middle 80s for me to eliminate the left side of the golf course.
So you changed your ball flight a little bit then.
I did. Every kid back in the 70s and early 80s hit a hook. I mean, there was one person I even knew that existed that hit a fade. That was like not even a thought. None of the kids I played with, none of the junior golfers, all through the, going through high school, the 70s, and even college.
Everybody fades it now.
Everybody fades it now. But you had woods and a lot of balls, and to hit it anywhere, you had to hit a hook. So basically that's what Peter Kostas told me in the summer 84 when I started working with him. He got me a driver that was unhookable. Basically, it was when the metal woods, remember when the TaylorMade metal woods first came out, it said metal on the top of it.
Yeah.
And you guys too young remember that, but
it was pre.
Oh, yeah.
They were like the size of a 7 wood now, but anyway, I got a 7-degree metal wood with a like a double extra stiff titanium shaft, and if you tried to hook the thing, it was going to fly about 100 yards in the air before it was diving into the ground. There's only one way to hit it, and that was to hang back, clear your left slot side, and swing left and hit a release fade. So I could essentially swing as hard as I wanted, as long as I did that, and release as hard as I wanted, and it wasn't going left. And that's the start of when I really started playing good.
Just straight face cuts with that chest. You clear your chest like better than anybody. That's what I've noticed. And you know, it just, the way you get through the ball is just, I mean, the face is so square. I mean, you had to just gotten a kick out of how square you maintained such a square face through the hitting area. I mean, you just had to knock down flags at that point.
I did. And that's, again, really, that's when I was playing my best, was when, I could just go ahead and just rip it and just release it. But it was a fade release. You know, it wasn't a flip release. And again, my best shots when I was in my prime, I'd aim right at it. Or even if the pin was back left and there's water over there, I knew I wasn't going to hit it left. I was either going to hit it right at it or it was going to be a slight push fade. And that's how a lot of guys today play. John Rahm, Dustin, JT, you name it. These guys, obviously distance is not an issue. So they have to find a way where they don't miss it left or start missing it both ways. That's the whole secret to those guys being as good as they are.
yeah, missing it in the left rough. I mean, if you're aiming for a fade and you hit it in the left, obviously you're screwed. But right. The years that I played well, my left rough percentage was crazy low. And, you know, if I ever missed it, it was in the right rough. But once right. The technology changed in 2016 and you could only adjust clubs 2 degrees one way or the other, I found it a lot harder to hit that bomb. The spin rate went down so much when the clubs yeah. changed, but back then you could really dial in your head, right? Like you could really flatten it or open it and do yeah. it kind of much as you want.
Exactly. And that's the thing now. I mean, I'm 61 and a half, narrowing in on 62. You know, I had my back fused last year. So, you know, I never thought about distance off the tee until I was about 56 when my back went south. So now I'm trying to find a driver that I can keep in the air, but doesn't spin much and doesn't go left. But that's the problem is so many of these drivers now have so little spin that if I get a driver that fades every time, it just dives right into the ground. Yeah. And that doesn't do me any good either. So, yeah. You know, it's with all you amateurs out there. It's never ending. Just like you guys, we're in search of a few extra yards too. Trust me, all of us are. So that's the great thing about golf. The challenge never ends.
It really does. And you can play it for pretty much forever. I mean, you know, you're back to playing now and you had a fusion a year ago. So, I mean, that's what we all love about the game. You know, the handicap system, you can play with anybody and the playing field is level. So, that's why it's such a great sport. And, you know, I love that you're still competing. I love that you're back out there. So none of the current ping drivers are working for you. I assume you're still a ping staffer.
I'm not. No? It's been a while. It's been 5 years, I think, since I left ping. My contract was up and they were going to give me next to nothing. And by that, I mean like 10,000. I said, you know what? I've been with ping for 33 years. Yep. And not that that's anything to sneeze at, but I thought at this stage of my career, I told Chance Cosby, who was then with Ping, now he's with the Thunderbird. I said, why don't you just give that money to one of your young and up and coming players? And I think it's time in my career that I just start trying some different stuff. And it was kind of fun. I started hitting, you know, a TaylorMade driver or a Callaway driver or whatever. So now I'm really with nobody. I do have a set of irons I love. I'm hitting those Srixon ZX5 irons, which are just nice. Beautiful.
Yeah,
they go through the ground so nice. Of course, I still have my Ping I2L wedge, which I could never get rid of, ever.
Very nice. So it doesn't have square grooves or anything?
No, as long as it says XG in the back of it, which means 2010 groove.
Okay.
It's legal. I've had a few people look at me like, is that thing legal?
Yeah.
It's still legal. And they have...
Things timeless.
They obviously don't make them anymore, but they have a box of them at Ping, and they only give them to the guys that kind of, even if I'm not with Ping, they'll give me one every couple of years just to put a new one in there, and because they know I've played it my whole life, basically.
Nice. I know me and Renner are like a mixed bag. Renner's, we've been sampling. It's just nice to be, you know, having the freedom to have a million different brands in the bag, and then you can just really toy with it. And it's like Christmas every day when you order new stuff.
Right. I see your sub 70 hat. Jason's been great to me. He's given me some irons and stuff. I love that company. I think they're making some fantastic stuff.
Oh man. You hear that, Jason Highland? endorsement.
You hear it? Yeah. You know, I like your stuff, Jason. You're doing amazing work, bud. Keep it up.
Yeah, they've done a great job in their 3 years that they've been open, and they've been nothing but nice to me. And so I give the hats to my students when I teach, and you know, I got a little pocket of Alabama that's all in on the sub 70. So yeah, I love their you know, the Tommy Armour set of clubs. I'm using the 639s, but yeah, I've their wedges are awesome too, and we need to get Renner a set of those just so he can sample them.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I know. Well, actually, Mark, you and I have a mutual friend, and he's a sub 70 guy himself, Randy Peterson.
Randy, I knew you were going to say Randy.
Yeah.
I've been watching bowling the last 3 nights at 8 o'clock past my bedtime. But yeah, Randy and I are good friends. We've been texting a bunch in the last few days. And he's all in on sub 70. He loves that stuff. He's a really good player. a couple of years ago. All the bowlers were down here, and I grew up in a bowling alley in Nebraska. My dad ran the bowling alley, so I had a 2-lane bowling alley a couple of houses ago in my house. But at any rate, we had a party over at the house, and every single bowler that was playing in the tournament came over, from EJ Tackett to Sean Rash to Wes Mallott to Norm Duke to Tommy Jones. The list goes on. All there were like 25 of them came over to my house for a cookout. Nice. And Sean, EJ, and Randy stayed at my house, and it was the best time. I love those guys, and I love watching bowling.
Are you a pretty decent bowler in your own right, I assume?
Yeah, I was. Those days I was talking about when I took off my Camaro, you know, with everything I owned in the car, my two bowling balls were behind my driver's seat. And even after, if I played in the morning, I'd go find a bowling alley and go bowl 5 or 6 games by myself.
I could maybe help the wedge game a little bit. I just loved releasing the right arm.
No kidding. So you wouldn't travel without the bowling ball then, huh?
No, I had it in my car all the time. And now, of course, Randy hooked me up with Storm, and now I've got 6 bowling balls in my garage that I haven't even drilled yet.
So Randy's the man. Very generous with hooking everyone up. He's giving a few bowling balls out.
Randy's awesome.
Yeah, he's a beauty, man. Love Randy.
Yeah, Renner was thinking about going to bring him in for a little guest appearance tonight, but I guess he's busy. Who's the guy that screamed, "Who do you think you are? I am," a few years ago?
That was Pete Weber.
Okay.
PDW. Yeah, it was he needed a 9 spare and a strike to win his 5th U.S. Open, which no one's ever done. And he left kind of a flat 10 pin on the 10th, picked that up. So I needed a strike for the win. And he got the strike. You know, he bowls in sunglasses.
Yeah,
and he gave it a few fist pumps, and then he ran over. He threw his sunglasses down on the lanes, and he screamed at the crowd, "Who do you think you are? I am."
It's like, yes, that means nothing, but it's such a highlight. I did it.
Oh my god, it's still one of the funniest sports reactions to win an event of all time. Every time I watch it, I laugh.
Oh, I started watching bowling after that. It hooked me,
and I got a chance to meet him. Last year and a half ago. So, and he's always been one of my favorites. So, yeah, awesome.
Yeah. He plays that nice little draw in there. That's so badass. So, another thing, since we're kind of on clubs, I know we're talking about bowling technically, but did you play the Ping Zing 2s at any point?
You know what? I tried them. I tried every iron that they came up with. And as a fader,
they were very offset.
Right. Well, and with that big toe thingy out there, the toe stayed open. So I hit them dead right. You know who loved them? The guys who hit hooks, like Lee Westwood and Kevin Sutherland, were the two best Ping Zing 2 players they had. But for me as a fader, I could not start them online. And no, didn't like them. Might have been the worst iron they ever made.
The I2s, did you played those forever?
Or? Yeah, the I2s I started with in 1984. I remember the day I called up Gary Hart, who used to be a Ping, and ordered a set. I was playing with Ken Green and Bill Sander at Detroit Golf Club, and it was raining. It was the Wednesday of the Buick Classic. We weren't in the Pro-Am, so we went down to Detroit and played. And I hit this 7-iron, my McGregor, Jack Nicklaus, muscle back, you know, irons with like pencils for grooves, and hit the 7-iron that went about 190 yards. I was trying to hit it about 150, and Bill Sander had these copper beryllium I2s with a squared
grip in
his bag. And he says, "Here, hit this." And he put my ball in the rough with a worse lie than the one I had. And I thought this thing was going to be a massive flyer. It came out, you could hear it spinning as it came out and hit the green and spun back a couple feet. Within 15 seconds, I was on the phone to Ping and said, "I'm going to need a set of copper beryllium I2 irons." You know what? And I played them for 20 years. And not only were they the best at that time, most forgiving iron, you know, and the square groove thing became a whole controversy through the late 80s, blah, blah, blah.
I didn't know it started that early.
Yeah. You know, when it started was in 87 when I won the Honda Classic. When I gouged an 8-iron out of the right rough at Eagle Trace, and it hit the green and jumped back about a foot. And Jack Nicklaus, Tom Watson, maybe Tom Weisskopf, and somebody else, Johnny Miller, went apeshit in the locker room. Like, that's impossible. That shouldn't happen. Those clubs are illegal. Whatever grooves he's using is illegal.
Wow.
And as time went on, you know, there was a big controversy about it. But, you know, I always said there were times when, yeah, they were an advantage, but there were also times when they weren't, when you were in the rough behind a tree and you needed to hit a flyer 9-iron just to get to the green.
Yeah. But,
you know, it came out soft and came up 20 yards short. So there were times when you would have loved it, been able to hit a flyer. But anyway, in 90, I switched to the Tommy Armour 845s, V grooves.
Oh, those are so good.
Just, yeah. They were great irons, very much like Ping's, just to prove a point. And I didn't win that year, but I had 6 seconds and had an amazing year. So, you know, I basically instantly proved everybody it wasn't the irons. It was pretty good. It was me.
Yeah. I mean, you're a superior ball striker. I mean, God, for God's sake.
I mean, geez, with that all going on, especially, it's cool to hear the in-depth, you know, conversation of what that would have like with the tournament, like you said, where you spun back an 8-iron and Jack and, you know, Weisskopf and all them are going nuts. I mean, that in today's world, if that was social media and stuff like that, I'm sure there would be this major controversy everywhere. It'd be like nuclear.
Right. It would have been humongous. You're right.
And then especially where you like say, I'm playing these different irons just to prove a point. I mean, that's kind of crazy to hear that it was like that with those clubs back in the day.
Yeah. And I really did like those 845s. I mean, they were very much like I2s to begin with. If you look at one of those now and look at an I2, they're almost identical. So it was a super easy transformation and Ping understood. And you know, I lived in Phoenix at the time, and every time I went over there, and even when I was playing those irons, they'd re-grip them for me or do whatever.
Yeah.
And then Carson would call me into his office, and he'd go, you know, Mark, there's nothing wrong with my groove. You know, and he'd sit me down for half an hour, and I couldn't get away from him. But, yeah, I said, yeah, I know, Carson, I know. Your groove's great. I get it. So, yeah, those were some interesting times.
It had to be a tough switch after winning the British in 89. And then you're like, all right, I'm changing clubs now. But you were doing it just to prove, like, you just didn't want any, you know, murmuring going on behind your back. Was that the main motivation?
100%. That was the sole motivation because, there was a lot of murmuring, you know, about the irons. And I wasn't the only guy playing good with them either. There were a lot of guys.
I mean, Phil Mickelson played the wedge still. I mean,
played the wedge. Yeah, he even threw it back in when they reinstated it about 10 years ago for a week or two, and then everybody gave him too much grief about it. But yeah. Tim Sampson was in a players' meeting. I'll never forget this. And he played I2s. I mean, he was one of the greatest ball strikers of that era. And, you know, he just looked at everybody and said, everybody just shut up. You know what's the truth? There's no grooves on Mark Calcavecchia's putter. I had this kind of shut everybody up because I was making a lot of putts back then. I could really go with the putter. So that was funny. I love that. I'm like, everybody's like, yeah, well, that's true.
Yeah. I mean, when you're having 26 putts around, were you like the blade answer or what was it?
I used an answer, old answer for the better part. Even kind of towards the late 90s and early 2000s, I was using an answer 2, which is essentially the same thing, just gold. But I did use an old answer. I know exactly where it's at in my garage. And I look at it every now and then. And, you know, it's super light. You know, back then the putters were so light. They didn't even weigh in the DOs or D1s. They were like C8 or C7. Which on the putting scale is pretty light. Now they're all like 350 grams, which is like EO. And, you know, all the putters now are fairly heavy. Nobody really uses a super light putter anymore.
Yeah, they're doing the counterbalancing thing now.
With the grips, crazy heavy. Whole thing, right.
Yeah, and it just keeps it moving through the hitting area. So I remember I had a Ping B60. When the B60, that thing was like a Coke can. It was so light.
Yeah, exactly. That's what Larry Nelson won the PGA with at Oakmont. Larry Nelson was awesome with that B60. Yeah. I actually won a tournament. I won the 88 Bank of Boston with a B61. But I've still got that one in the garage. And like I said, it's so light. You wonder how you even putted with those things. Back then, you didn't know about heavy putters. Nobody used one. Everybody's putter was light.
Ignorance is bliss.
Yeah, just like the research of the game is, especially from what you've seen, I'm sure, from the clubs that you've played over the years. And like you said, the Ping grooves was an issue. And then, you're talking about Balata golf balls and just a totally different game than what it is now. So it's just that you've, and you've played great golf in every single era, which is awesome. And there's not many people that can say that. So that's got to be interesting to see how the equipment has changed and just the little things, maybe I'm sure that you've noticed in the changes in your game, over time.
I mean, especially not as artistic of a game as it used to be.
That's a good point. It really isn't. I'm a big fan of the PGA Tour. Obviously, I'm a golf fan. I watch the ladies. I watch the seniors. I watch us play. I watch the PGA Tour. I watch the amateurs in the USAM and
US seniors a blast to watch.
Oh, I agree. It's pretty entertaining, and I know a lot of these guys. I play with Eric Cole a lot at Sequesta. Dylan Meyer, and I watch the way these kids play, and it's just awesome to watch. It really is. Yeah, granted, the ball goes further than ever. The drivers are amazing, but everybody's technology, everybody's technique is so good today. And their short games are just amazing. And that's the main difference, really. Technology's helped a ton, but golfers are better today than they used to be, and there's no doubt about that.
Yeah, the depth is crazy now. The Korn Ferry Tour. Played last year on the Korn, and the cuts are 6 under every week.
I know. And I played some of those courses. I don't get it. And like I said, I played a lot with Eric Cole, and he's doing pretty well this year on the Korn Ferry. But I'm like, this guy is so good. How can he not get through this and get on a PGA Tour? And I think he's 32 now, but he's having a good year this year. But that just goes to show you how good everybody is. And it's never been harder than it is today to get on the PGA Tour and stay there for that matter.
Yeah, it's crazy. Eric Cole packs a punch in that small frame.
He does.
Obviously, he's got a lot of pedigree. Mom and dad both were professional. Yeah. He shoots 65 with his eyes shut around TCC.
he does.
It's a draw golf course, so that plays well for him. Right. But yeah, I loved playing with Eric, and I'm glad to see that he's doing good. I assume, is Hunter caddying for him, that big, tall Hunter O'Mahony kid?
No, actually, Eric this year hired Russ's son, Russ Cochran's son, Reed.
Oh, yeah, he's an awesome caddy.
Yeah, Reed was caddying for Curtis Luck last year on the Korn Ferry, and this year with Curtis, I don't think has full status, but Eric does now. So Reed Cochran is caddying for Eric, and obviously hoping they get to the PGA Tour next year, and that's going to be his guy.
Yeah, Reed's he's a great caddy. He has a law degree or something.
He does. He's a lawyer. Yeah, he's got a full-fledged law degree. Yeah. All right. Yeah. So if you ever need a lawyer in a pinch,
I'll send you his number. He's a good guy to be out there,
a good guy to know, right?
Yeah. Well, hopefully I'm past that part of my life.
Yeah.
That's cool. I wish I was still a member of TCC. God, you don't have a choice.
I remember out there. Yeah. Heck yeah. We had fun out there.
Yeah. I saw you one day on the putting green with Russ, and maybe Jim Thorpe was out there that day. I'm not really sure, but and then obviously I gave you, I told you to not spend that check from that pro-am in one place.
I remember that.
the cops pro-am. I was like, I'm walking up to Mark Hockebeck in. I'm making fun of the fact that he just got a $1,500 check, and that's a drop in the bucket.
No, it's like $3,200, by the way. I was pretty excited.
Oh, hell yeah.
Nice. Right. Don't spend that all in one place. That was funny.
Episode 6 of Tier Time was brought to you by AverageDadGolf.com. This is a hub for busy people to sift through the noise and find resources to play more, play better, and enjoy the game for a lifetime. With the help of renowned coaches and industry experts, he will do the work for you in finding relevant information for learning the game, finding equipment, and passing the game on to the next generation. So can't thank Average Dad Golf enough for being a sponsor for this episode. This episode of Tier Time is brought to you by Red Rooster Golf. Here's one of the most underrated pieces of equipment in the game, a buttery soft golf glove. I love slipping on a fresh, perfectly fitting glove on the first tee. It's such a great feeling and it sets the proper tone for the round. A good fitting quality glove is something we tour pros used to take for granted because we got 4 to 5 every week. They were practically disposable. Now that we've got to pay for our gloves, they are no less important. So, that got our buddy and former PGA Tour pro Brad Fritch to develop an innovative new venture called Red Rooster Golf. They make tour-quality golf gloves at fair prices, delivered by flexible subscription exactly when you need them. And here's the best part. When you buy a glove, they give a glove to youth golf. How cool is that? I saw Red Rooster launch through Kickstarter last year, one of the few golf brands to have success in crowdfunding. More than 1,000 backers and raised over $75,000. Great for them. I love so many things about this company at Red Rooster Golf. First, the gloves are badass. As good as any of the top brands, super soft Cabretta leather, and really durable. They offer a wide range of styles, from classic pearl white options to subtle tones to bold colors. You can purchase the gloves on their own or sign up for their flexible subscription service and save. Get a glove every month or every quarter, pause, increase, decrease, you're in control. But the subscription is really where it's at. Most golfers don't know where their next glove is coming from. So when a fresh new glove arrives in the mail, it's a great reminder that your current glove needs to rotate to the practice squad. They're also selling what's called the glove compartment. Love that name. It's a glove case to keep those beautiful gloves flat and dry so they last longer. Right now, they're offering a 40% discount on your first glove plus glove compartment with any subscription. You'll find that right on the homepage at redroostergolf.com. But if you just want to give one of their gloves a spin before you commit to a subscription, no sweat. That makes perfect sense. We've got a special 20% discount for y'all. Enter coupon code TIER20. That's TIER and the number 2020 at checkout, and you'll save 20% off your first purchase. So, visit my pal Brad and the team at Red Rooster Golf and wake up that golf glove game. Stay tiered. Well, we obviously got to talk about Royal Troon. We've, you know, covered some really great stuff, and you've elaborated much more than, I mean, it's fantastic listening to all of this. But at Troon, you didn't know it was a four-hole aggregate. And so who told you that? Like, obviously they tell you the format when you're about to tee off, but when you finished on the 72nd hole, were you, I mean, did you think it was just going to be obviously sudden death?
Well, after I finished, I knew I had to birdie the last hole to tie Greg Norman because I saw that he was in at 13 under.
Okay.
And hit a great 8-iron and they're close and made birdie. But at the time, Wayne Grady was still 15 under with 5 holes to go. And he ended up bogeying 14 and 17, the 2 par 3s. And when he didn't birdie 18, I said, okay, we're in a playoff. So there's an RNA guy standing right there. And I said to him, I said, I assume we're going back to 18, right? He goes, no, we're going to 1. And 1 is by far the easiest hole in the course. It's a 350-yard straightaway par 4 with a couple little bunkers out there that you couldn't really hit if you tried. And I'm like, well, that's a weird hole for a playoff. He goes, no, I said, I thought we were going to go to 18. He says, no, we're playing 1, 2, 17, and 18. And I had absolutely no idea. they announced it at the beginning of the week, but, you know, the beginning of the week, you're not really paying attention to what the playoff holes are. You're just, that's the farthest thing from your mind. So, that actually relaxed me quite a bit, and I was relieved to hear that.
Yeah, and you won that playoff by a couple, right?
As it turned out, yeah. Greg, in regulation, Norman birdied the first six holes. And then in the playoff, he birdied one and two again. I made a three-footer on two. Right. What's that?
He had an X in there somewhere. Didn't he have a disaster?
Well, on the last hole. So then we go to 17. He's two under. I'm one under. And Wayne Grady's even. So Wayne Grady bogeys 17 again for the fifth straight time.
Wow.
I hit a really good 3-iron on the green, which I was happy with. And Greg blistered a 4-iron over the green. He was 3 feet over the green and had one weed in front of him. I'm standing just to the right of him. I mean, it's a putter. Only Ray Floyd would have chipped this in his prime. It's a putter 100% of the time. And next thing I know, he lifts out like a 7-iron. So I whacked my buddy in the arm and I said, "Can you believe he's chipping this?" And he chipped it. I don't know if he's worried about the little weed in front of him or whatever, but he chipped it about 10 feet by. I almost made my 50 footer and he missed. So we're tied going into 18. Now, and Wayne Grady made bogey. So we're both one under and Wayne Grady's one over. So Greg, I get up there. I never hit a 3-wood off the tee at that time. I either hit a 1-iron or a driver. So in regulation, I hit a driver. I hit it really good, but I was no more than 4 yards behind that bunker that Norman ended up hitting it in. So I knew that bunker was reachable. So in the playoff, I'm like, I'm all jacked up. Don't smoke one in that bunker. So I just kind of fan one out to the right. Terrible drive, right? Anyway.
A heel Norman, cut, but it ended up in the fairway?
No, it was in the right rough, but it was really wispy, light rough.
Yeah.
Norman gets up there. Wayne Grady hits one down the fairway. Norman gets up there and just blisters one. And I'm on the left side of the tee. Him and Bruce Edwards, the late, great Bruce Edwards, God bless him, said, "Beauty, Greg." Greg hits it. It's going right down the middle and starting to fade. And I'm on the left side of the tee and I'm looking at it and I'm thinking to myself, as hard as he hit that, if this kicks a little right, he's going to catch that death bunker, that little coffin bunker. I think it's called coffin bunker, by the way, because it looks like a coffin.
They name everything over there.
Right. They do. Every bunker's got a name. So, yeah. So they're like 20 yards off the tee and this ball's still rolling. And I'm still on the side of the tee looking at it. And I'm like, get right, get right. And sure enough, I saw this thing catch this corner of this bunker by like 8 inches and it rolled up. And I knew he was screwed right from the get-go.
Right under the lip.
Right under the lip. And so anyway, I get over there to my drive. I'm 50 yards behind where he's at. I hit a 5-iron out of the light rough from 201 yards. And it never left the flag. Still the greatest shot I've ever hit to this day. And it looked like it was about 3 feet from back there. The crowd was going crazy. So Norman gets in this bunker and he thinks he's got to try to do something heroic. And he hit it as far as he could hit it, but he hit it into the cross bunker about 50 yards short of the green. And then he proceeded to hit that one in the clubhouse, which is OB. And
so then you enjoyed the walk.
He just picked up after that. I knew I could three putt. Wayne Grady actually hit in there close. He putted first, tapped in to get back to one over. So I knew I could three or four putt from 7 feet and still win. So, yeah, that was remember it like it was yesterday.
Yeah, man, I can't imagine that. What's the best alcoholic beverage you've sipped out of the claret jug?
There's been several. You know, a lot of beers amongst them. Some really nice champagne, some Dom, some Cristal.
Love it.
Probably not really anything like vodka or bourbon or anything, but yeah. Right before I had to bring it back. So the next year, the Open's at St. Andrews in 1990, and we have the player dinner, which is cool, every 5 years. And the invitation said 7 for 7:30. So I thought that meant like 7:30. Evidently, you're supposed to get there by 7. At any rate, friends of mine from home came over. We're in the Old Course Hotel. We're guzzling champagne out of it. And then all of a sudden, I realized it was about 7:20. And I said, oh, shit, I got to go. So I wrenched it out briefly, but it still had champagne in it. The courtesy car wasn't there to pick me up. So anyway, I was about 15 minutes late. I got there at 7:45, not thinking it was a big deal. I got roasted in the media and the tabloids over there for being late and showing up with champagne and the cup and all this other crap. It was pretty funny though.
That's something you look back on and love.
There was still champagne dripping out of the cup when I brought it back.
I love that though. That's awesome. Like just showing up casually, 7:45. What's up, guys? What's going on? Right? Hey.
Everybody's looking at me like, where the hell you been?
Anyone else want a pull of the claret jug with some champagne left over?
I said, what do you mean? I'm barely late. I said my car was late.
Still celebrating the win.
17 up to 18 grand, carrying that thing.
That's awesome. That's good stuff.
Nice. And then they just give you a replica, which is on your shelf now.
Well, they give you one for about $6,000.
What?
They don't give you anything. So anyway, the replica, the first one I got the next year was 2/3 the size. So it's 66% the size. And it was like 4,000 pounds. It was like $6,000. I said, well, I don't care. I got to have one.
You got it.
Sure enough, about 3 years later, they come up with a new replica. It's 90% the size. I'm looking at it right now as we speak. It's on top of my case over by my TV. It looks so you can't. It's an inch shorter than the real jug, and it's absolutely gorgeous. And it was twice as cheap as the short one. So I said, "Well, I got to have one of those too." So I got that one too.
That's quite the racket they were running then, huh?
Right. Sure.
I love how they bump it up to 90%. They got 90%. We'll go with that.
Yeah.
So anyway, speaking of the Open, I'm really excited. When you win the Open, you're exempt until you're 60, unless you're Greg Norman or Tom Watson, who almost won the Open when they were 59. Mm-hmm. They got an extra 5 years. But anyway, 2020 was supposed to be my last Open at Royal St. George's. Of course, COVID canceled that. And then last January, I had the back surgery and I didn't touch a club till August, so I couldn't play. So I wrote this big old long sappy letter about how I really wanted to play my last Open. My kids have never been to St. Andrews, blah, 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 all this. The RNA was great. They do treat their past champions amazing. And they said, you can play your last Open this year at St. Andrews. So I'm super excited about that. And again, the past champions dinner is something special, much like the Masters dinner they have every year. But at the Open, they only have it at St. Andrews, so it's going to be awesome.
Wow, that's so cool! I played the St. Andrews Lynx Trophy, which is a big amateur event over there. So I got to play the old a couple of times, and then we sat on the roof or the top floor on the balcony of the St. Andrews Club and drank beers and watched people come in. And it was it's such a cool experience. And, can't wear, golf shoes in the clubhouse, no hats and all that. Right. I had long shaggy hair and I looked like a total hobo in there, but it was, it's just being in that town. It feels like you're in a movie or something. It's just so surreal.
It is an amazing atmosphere. It's just hard to describe. You've been there, so you know what it's like.
Yeah, but a kid on my college golf team works for the RNA now, so he'll be what do they call them, referees over there or something like that. He'll actually be working the event as a rules official. I mean, this guy's only 33 years old, so he's rocketing up the
race. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, Daniel Somerville. Maybe you'll come across him, and hopefully he'll give you a good drop if you need
it. All right, I'll remember that, Daniel Somerville.
Yeah, good man. Another thing I wanted to touch on was you played, over 750 events on the PGA Tour with 142 top tens. And I just chuckled at that because they make such a big deal out of the 600. What do they do for you? Do they give you a cake or something when you make it to 700 or 750? Like, it's such a legendary amount.
I remember when they made a big deal out of Lee Westwood playing in his 500th tournament. I said, I made 528 cuts. I mean, who cares? Speaking of that, oh, by the way, not to toot my horn, but accounting the PGA Tour and the Champions Tour, in Dallas in 3 weeks, it's going to be my 1,000th tournament.
PGA sanctioned.
PGA sanctioned, PGA Tour and Champions Tour. I mean, of course, Jay Haas is leading that, and he's still playing, so that'll never be caught. And Jeff Sluman's got over 1,000, but I'm pretty sure I'm the next in line. So, you know, when you think, I stop and think all the time, you know, when I watch tournaments, I watch Bay Hill, or I watch Valspar, or I watch the Players or whatever, and I think, man, I played in that tournament 25 times. It's just, where did the time go? I can't even imagine. You know, this is going to be my 31st Open. I don't even remember flying over there 5 times, let alone 31 times. You know, I mean, it's just...
That is quite the journey from the beginning.
The journey that I've been on over 41 years is... I'd say it's gone by fast, and I've had a blast, but it's all kind of a blur, amazingly. And I remember more from 20 or 25 years ago than I do from 3 or 4 years ago. It's kind of weird.
Join the club with that one, I guess, right?
All right.
Yeah, but the memories I have from when I'm about 26 are a lot more clear than the ones I had from 2 years ago, for sure. Granted, things were a little more exciting on the PGA Tour than they are giving lessons to 18 handicappers. But when you're on the road, like, you know, it goes by so quick. How many events did you like to play in a year? Were you like a 25, 28, 30? What would you normally do?
I think, when I first became fully exempt in the late 80s, I think I played 32, 33, a year, most of them. It just felt weird skipping a tournament, you know. It's like, God, what am I doing, you know? Because I laugh now when I see these 23 or 24 or 5-year-olds say they're tired or burnt out or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, come on, really? that never crossed my mind or any of my friends' minds when we were in our mid-20s and the mid-80s. We'd play anywhere and everywhere we could and appreciate it. So I get it now. I mean, of course, I'm old. I'm 61 and a half, like I said, but golf over the years kind of has taken a toll, but man, when I was young, I couldn't wait to play. And I still, at my age, get excited to go play. I really do. And that's why I'm still doing it.
Yeah. That's awesome. When's the next start for you? You say you're playing Dallas?
Yeah, actually 2 weeks from today is a tournament in Biloxi called the Rapsican. It's at a different course in Biloxi, Mississippi.
It's not at the Bow, Rivage, or whatever.
Well, I say at the Hard Rock. I say it at the Bow. We used to play a course called Fallen Oak. Now we're playing a place called Grand Bear, which is a Nicklaus course. It's actually just like 5 miles north of the Gulfport Airport. And then we have 1 week off, and then we have 4 in a row where we do that new tournament in Dallas. It's called the Club Corp. It's going to be kind of like a AT&T where one pro – one celebrity and 2 amateurs with each group, or 2 celebrities and 1 amateur. I can't remember which, but you remember the Diamond Resorts tournament that the Champions Tour had for a few years, but now the ladies play with all the baseball players and hockey players. And it's in Orlando. It's their first tournament of the year.
Yeah.
That's kind of moving back to our tour in Dallas called the Club Corp. So that'll be super cool to see all those guys again all those famous athletes that I've met over the years, Jerry Rice and pitchers, you name it. I mean, there's just tons of guys. It's going to be a super fun event.
I think that'll be more fun for the AMs. I mean, it's got to be more laid back on the Champions Tour. I mean, is the environment pretty relaxed out there? I mean, you guys obviously just being there, you had a great career. I assume, a lot more personable and not as clicky and, things like that up there.
Correct. And true, we are. I can't tell you how many programs I've played in, and I do my best. I'm very personable. My first goal is to make sure my amateurs have a great time, and I don't care if they're good players or bad players. 99% of them are all super nice guys and or girls with the women I play with. But a bunch of times I played with players in the pro-am and I'm doing my best job. And they say, well, 2 weeks ago I played with so-and-so. I'm not going to name names in the pro-am at the wherever, Honda or wherever. He said hello in the first tee, looked at his phone for 18 holes and said goodbye in the last green. And I'm like, that's just ridiculous. Nice. I mean, these people play a lot of money and it's unacceptable. Anyway, I know that's just a super duper rare exception. I mean, most everybody's very nice and on both tours, but everybody on our tour gets it. We've been there. We've been doing this for 30 or 40 years, and it's important to be nice to these people.
Absolutely. I mean, it's part of the gig, you know.
It is. It's part of the game. That's the other question. Do you get tired of playing these things? I said, no, never. I mean, it's we try new drivers, we try new putters, we try new wedges. It's my practice round. The only time it sucks is when the weather's horrible, if it's freezing cold and or raining or both, because nobody wants to play in that. You're hiding under your umbrella. You know, it's miserable. You can't talk to anybody. Everybody's running for cover. So, I mean, one time out of 100, it's miserable, but it's part of our job. And like I said, I've been doing it for 41 years. And I've still got tons of great friends over the years that I still talk to on a daily basis that I played in pro-ams with.
And for the AMs, it's like one of the best days of their life. So,
right.
No, you got to cater to that.
It is. It's something they look forward to. And I'm always first off. And I always was on my PGA Tour career as well, because I wake up early. You know, I like to play fast. I like to have the afternoon off. So, you know, a lot of times when we're out there at 6:50 or 7 o'clock and it's still kind of half dark, and I'm like, how do you guys get the, you know, wake up call with me? And they're like, oh, we asked for it. We couldn't wait to play with you. You know, they said, we don't care if you played at 5. You know, we were going to get up and play with you. So that's kind of a good compliment too.
Yeah. Your era's got such better like characters, in my opinion. Y'all just weren't robots. I mean, you know, between the way you hit the ball to just the amount of fun you had after the rounds, after the tournaments and stuff. Nowadays, everybody goes straight to the hotel and that's it. You know, it's
just, right.
Our guy Boros was still playing when I got out there in 10-11, and I just was like, this guy has a big time. And now that's faded out, and everybody's just ultra focused, and half the guys have their moms traveling with them, and it's just like, this is a different deal.
Our tour, we get done with the morning pro-am, right? A lot of guys will either, you know, on the tour will go straight to the range or have lunch and then go to the range, and You go up into the dining room and you'll see almost every single pro, me included, having lunch with your amateur team, you know, on top of spending 5 hours with them on the course. So, you get time, go spend 20 minutes and have a, you know, piece of chicken and a Coke with them or something, or a beer or whatever. Mm-hmm. Go hit some ball, you know, do your thing. And that's what we do on our tour. And I think that's why it's been very successful. While we continue to keep the sponsors we have and renew the sponsorships we have. Guys put in a lot of effort and it's worth it.
And the thing of it is too, like what you said, it's just when you were saying back, like when you first started on tour, you played every week because it's like you were grateful for that opportunity to have a chance. And, you know, your generation certainly has that perspective and they know how to treat people. And you guys remember like what it was like when you had to kind of scratch and claw, you're traveling everywhere. It's, you guys know the grind of it. So,
right.
You know, when you guys are dealing with, you know, the pro-ams and playing in the pro-ams, you guys come at it from a very, very good perspective on how to treat people and like, you know, be normal with them and let them enjoy the day because the day is about them for the most part. And, you know, I'm sure they're all pretty grateful for, you know, getting a guy like you. That's for sure.
Well, it is. And I appreciate that. And Peter Jacobs, the biggest supporter of this. I mean, he's been telling everybody for years, it's not about us. It's about our sponsors, their clients, their customers, the pro-ams. They're the people that put up the money and, you know, we wouldn't have a tournament without them. So,
Peter Jacobson?
Yeah, Peter Jakeston. He's been amazing over the years.
Such a nice guy.
And that's why he's been so successful and has so many friends and sponsors. And he's the ultimate. He really is. He's the best there is at that.
Yeah. He was a Strixon guy. So, Renner, I mean, we shot a commercial of him runtime, right? At North Shore?
Yeah, back in the day, North Shore, yeah.
Yeah, that was really cool.
He was just a great guy. You can tell why people gravitate towards him. And when he talks, people listen. So you can understand, you know, he comes at it from a good point of view. That's for sure.
Yeah, he could, do a hell of a podcast, but he's got so many TV, you know, obligations now and everything's just, yeah, he doesn't need to play. Does he compete anymore or just like?
You know what? He played the AT&T this year. It's his last competitive tournament ever on any tour. And I was proud of him. He finished all three rounds. I think he's 70 years old now. And he's had close to 30 surgeries. Oh, I'm going to say upper 20s anyway. He's had his issues, but he keeps plugging away, and he's still funnier and funny. I mean, you've seen his clinics when he does the Stadler, the Trevino, or you know when he does Arnie, and it's just he's just absolutely hysterical. Very funny man.
He's a great ambassador for the game.
Great guitar player, good singer. I mean, he's a musician. He's pretty awesome.
Yeah, he's kind of ageless. He's kind of like Nick Saban. Right. I would have never guessed 70. I would have thought he was, you know, in your range. You know?
Yeah, right.
I can't believe he's had that many surgeries. That's insane.
Yeah.
I mean, that's brutal.
Oh, a lot of them in the last 10 years, too. I mean, he was having a couple of a year there for a while on his back, his shoulder, hip replacement. I think he had a knee replacement. Yeah, you name it.
He could probably be a doctor by now.
Yeah, he ought to be in pretty good shape by now. He might make a comeback.
The $6 million man. I guess, Renner, we do a little E9 segment where Renner's going to ask you nine questions about your favorite sports teams and so on. But what do you think about what's going on with Greg Norman in this Saudi league? Like, I just figured I'd throw that out there to see if you had any opinion on it.
Well, I saw they just came out with a schedule of 8 or 9 tournaments today.
Yeah.
I saw it on Twitter. I'm not sure who's going to be playing in them.
Right. I mean, who is going to just give up their tour status?
Right. Of course, Greg says that the tour has no right to, you know, tell anybody they can or cannot play, or they'll never play the PGA Tour again if they play in this league. But, you know, and then a lot of guys a few weeks ago came out and said, I support the PGA Tour. I just don't know who's going to play in these events. I still don't think they're going to happen. But, you know, Greg tried to do this, you know, 15 years ago, and then Fincham came up with the, the World Golf events in spite of, I think, Greg Norman. Which is kind of what he was trying to do in the first place. But
yeah, see, that's what I remember. And I figured that I was like, this whole thing is kind of coming full circle with Norman.
Right.
Like, okay, now I'm going to try to do my thing my way. And it just doesn't seem like it's, you're just not going to have the players. It's just, I mean, yeah, all those ideas, the money and everything like that. But if you don't have the players, you don't have nothing.
If Jason Kokrak and Jason Duffner are your two top players, and Ian Poulter, I don't think you're going to get too many viewers or spectators for that. So,
not going to move.
Not taking anything away from those guys. They've had great careers, and Kokrak's been playing great. But without the top, you know, say 15 of the 20 players in the world, it's just not going to fly, and that's not going to happen.
Yeah, and the tour is kind of like initial knee-jerk reaction is like to bump up purses, and it's just going to keep going up. I mean, I think the money's going to be very comparable. I mean, it's obviously I played the players in 16, and it's gone up $9 million since then.
Yeah,
and you know, so the tour is, you know, they're obviously reacting to it, and they're wanting to dump more money into, you know, the PIP program went up $10 million this year. I mean, they're throwing cash all over the place. So I just don't see why anybody would leave the tour. I mean, they've been dreaming about it since they're kids. I mean,
I don't either. And like I said, I mean, Bay Hill was $12 million purse. I mean,
it's just nuts.
The money's crazy. It's.
And there is like the competition part to it too, where, you know, these guys want to compete against each other and the best players in the world. And I mean, even if the money is that, I get it's a money grab kind of thing, but I mean, these guys want to be pushing their games. They want to play against the best people. And if you don't have that week in, week out, I mean, I just don't know what you're really signing up to watch.
Right. And like a few guys said, you know, they're talking about the history of the PGA Tour, the steps that guys have taken before them to lay the ground. And, you know, they still want to be a part of that. You know, if somebody says who won the 2022, you know, whatever classic in the middle of nowhere, nobody's going to care.
Yeah.
You know, it's there's a lot of history at the PGA Tour, and there's so much money there now. I don't see anything.
Yeah, you can't turn that back on the legends. Like, I mean, who's going to skip the Memorial and Bay Hill? I mean, you wouldn't have the opportunity to play in any of those events. Screw that. And I mean, I just don't see anybody that's less than 30 years old just cashing out. I mean, maybe people that are in their 40s, you know, maybe Stenson, guys like that. But yeah, I just don't think it, you know, I think if the tour sued them, they probably wouldn't, you know, I mean, they are private contractors, PGA Tour players, but you know, hopefully it doesn't get too messy. I think it'll run its course and just disappear eventually.
That's what I'm thinking too.
Yeah. So, well, Renner, you want to run down that E9 for us?
All right. Just a few little things we just put down here. Figured fire a few quick questions off to you. So, right. Number one would be favorite band.
Rush.
All right. Favorite food while on the road.
Boy, that's a tough one.
Mine's sushi.
I shake it up. We just had sushi tonight.
Nice. Can't go wrong with sushi, man.
I do always trying to find a killer sushi joint close by.
Chow cab?
Yeah. Yes, let's go sushi.
All right, we all agree on that. Beautiful. favorite golfer growing up, and then your favorite golfer right now you like watching.
Favorite golfer growing up was Jack Nicklaus. Always will be my idol. Mm-hmm. And over the last 20 years, my favorite golfer to watch is Phil Mickelson, just because of the places he hits it and the stuff that he gets himself out of is just still mind-boggling to this day.
He's Houdini out there with those nuts.
It's so crazy where he can hit it and how he can hit it that far offline and still break par. Crazy.
Yeah, just what his eyes and mind, like how they operate is kind of crazy sometimes.
Total genius.
All right, and then favorite athlete, any sport?
Well, Tiger Woods.
There we go.
Can't go wrong. Favorite golf course?
Sand Hills in the middle of nowhere, Nebraska.
Yeah, all right.
No less, right?
That's a nice one. I have a very golf snobby friend, a good friend of mine, Andrew Buckman. He will love that because that's his favorite joint there. Sand Hill.
Oh, my God. It's incredible. I've been there 4 or 5 times. What's that?
A couple hours west of Omaha. It's kind of in the dunes out there.
It's right in the middle of Nebraska. No, it's like 5 hours from Omaha.
They didn't like
go across I-80 to North Platte through Lincoln and then an hour and 20 minutes north of North Platte. You're driving up there and you're like, there's no way in the world there's a golf course out here. You think you're on the moon.
Yeah, and that's so funny. That's what people have said.
Every hole is fantastic. We were out there a couple of years ago with Lee Jansen, and I'll never forget what he said on whatever hole it was. He says, man, just one amazing hole after another. And that's what it is. It's spectacular.
Kind of like Prairie Dunes out in the middle of nowhere.
Exactly. Prairie Dunes is right up there with me. The first time I played Sand Hills, we we're in Colorado Springs. We took a plane, private plane, to North Platte with my stepfather-in-law and two buddies. Played Sand Hills, flew down to Wichita, played Prairie Dunes the next morning, and then flew back. A great day. Two of my favorites.
That's really trip. Cool. Now, favorite golf hole?
I'm going to say, without a doubt, 12 at Augusta National.
Wow. Okay. I like that. Very nice.
Yeah.
Now, how do you fare? How do you fare on the 12th hole throughout your career playing the Masters? What was the win like for you? Is it as confusing as everyone says it is? I mean, you've played there so many times. Just how would that hole play year in, year out, I guess, or even day to day?
Yeah, it is. When you're standing on the tee and it feels like you're into the wind, and you look over at the flag on number 11, it's going downwind, or vice versa. You know, it's only 135 to the front left pin and 155 to the, or 150 to the back right pin.
Yeah.
But it's terrifying. I've made everywhere from, I've looked out for hole in one, and I've made a seven there, a quad, which I remember well. It was probably the hardest I've ever seen Sergio Garcia laugh.
Was it anyway, kind of like Spieth's disaster? Just hit the water and
pretty right much
inside? Just kept hitting it in the water.
I hit it in the water. The pin was front left. Hit the bank, rolled in the water, went over, kind of took the angle, dropped, and I hit this L wedge that I knew I just spun the crap out of, and it flew a foot from the hole, but I was doomed. It spun back in the water. Then I hit the next one on the green. And playing with Sergio, and I can't remember who else. And I get up there, and I got a 15-footer for triple. And they're standing there kind of looking at me. I asked where their marks were, blah, blah, blah. So I'm out. Nobody bothered to fix my ball mark the whole time while I'm milling around, walking over the bridge over by 13T to get to the green.
Wow.
So that kind of pissed me off. So then I go to pull my ball marker, my Muirfield Village ball repair thing, out of my pocket, and I had this pair of pants on that had the pocket inside the pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right. You know what I'm talking about?
You can wrestle it out.
Yeah,
it was stuck. It was jammed. So now I stick my middle finger in there and I grab it, and I'm so mad, I just ripped it as hard as I could. Tees, coins, everywhere went flying all over the green, and I ripped my pants from my pocket all the way down to my knee. So now my knee and underwear are hanging out. Sergio Garcia's on the ground laughing. I can't even, he'll remember who our other player playing partner was, but it was the hardest I've ever seen him laugh.
What year was that?
Oh, geez. Might've been the last year I played, maybe 09.
Okay.
the nine birdies year.
Yeah. So I two putt tap in for the smooth nine. And then I just decided to rip my pants the rest of the way. So now, basically, I'm walking with my pants ripped from my pocket on my right leg all the way down to my shoe, with my leg hanging out. And they just kept laughing at me all day. So that was probably my last time playing that hole.
Oh, that's classic. All right. Yeah, and then favorite post-round drink? Champagne out of the claret jug.
Yeah, that was a good one. Yeah, right. Quick story regarding that. So we're staying at this place in Ayr, A-Y-R, Ayr, 15 minutes south of Troon at a hotel called the British Caledonian. Now it's a Ramada Inn, and they have a bar on the fourth floor. So, of course, me and my buddy, every night we stayed there. We went up and either had dinner there or had a couple beers up there. And early in the week, you know, got to talking to the bartender and some people, and told them who I was, and a couple of them recognized me, and they said, well, I said, look, after I win this tournament, I'm going to bring the claret jug back in here, and we're going to have a wicked party. And they're like, yeah, okay, sure. So sure enough, 6 days later, after I got in with all the media, marched straight up the stairs to the fourth floor of the bar, and there's about 100 people in there, and they erupted when I walked in there with a big grin on my face with a clear jug held up over my head. And everybody drank out of it that night. I don't even remember going to the airport the next morning or getting on the plane. There wasn't any sleep, I don't think. But yeah, that was quite the party.
That's awesome. They're probably watching that golf like he's going to show up right here with that claret jug. Right? He said 6 days earlier. That's awesome.
They were waiting for me. They knew I was going to come. And I did.
That's great. That's great.
And you just become Scotland's, you know, a favorite son immediately when you went over there. I mean, everybody, so much respect. Like, when I made the cut in the dang Lynx trophy, they treated me so much different. So I can't imagine if you won the British, how the Scottish people treat you.
They do. And everybody recognizes me. And even to this day, I mean, at St. Andrews is going to be awesome. The receptions around the greens are different. My first Open in 87 at Muirfield, I knew it was the coolest tournament in the world. And that was even after I played in the Masters that year. I finished, I think, 10th that year. And I thought to myself, this is by far the coolest golf tournament in the world. The fans, the atmosphere, the courses. It's not so fun when you get stuck in some bad weather. But at any rate, it's been a great ride, that's for sure.
It's so respectful over there. It's really cool to play in front of those crowds, and even playing in Asia, you know, the same way. I mean, it's in the States, it seems to be the only place where they really razz you and, you know, kind of give you shit when you hit bad shots.
Yeah, I remember when my wife who's blonde, when we first went to Korea in 2005. She's a tall, pretty blonde, and there was a lady there who the whole week walked around with her and held an umbrella overhead because she didn't want her to get tanned. She didn't want her to get sunburned.
Wow.
it's incredible.
Unbelievable respect.
It is. It's unbelievable.
That's great hospitality right there.
That sure is.
Wow. Yeah, the women, they love golf over there. I got prepared with in the Dun. Did you ever play the Dunlop Phoenix Open?
I never did, believe it or not. I played the Bridgestone a bunch and the one down at Kagoshima and the Golf Digest, and I never played Phoenix, though.
I got paired with Ryo Ishikawa and Hideto Tanihara, and you know, Ishikawa's like, he's like the Justin Bieber of golf over there.
Right.
And there was probably 1,000 people following our group, and I bet 90% of them were women, and it's just
really?
It was wild, yeah. And then I remember they told me they hit it on Tanihara, best putter in Japan. I was like, yeah, we'll see about that. And this dude proceeded to quack hook like 8 drives that day and shoot 71 and just dripped it in from 40 feet on like 4 different holes. And it was driving me nuts.
Right.
I was amazed, but at the same time, I'm like, this guy just should have shot 85, but man, they get a lot out of their games over there with the way they roll the pill.
Yes, they do.
I guess the last thing I want to talk about is just the assault that you did on TPC Scottsdale. Your smallest margin of victory was 5 shots, and you obviously set the scoring record. Cam Smith obviously broke it this year, but well, maybe Ernie Els was shot 30 under, but I mean, can you really count the tournament of champions? I don't know. I think your 4-round event in a full field, that still has got a lot more cachet. But what did you love? I mean, obviously you lived there, so it felt like it was a hometown event for you. But like, what about TPC just fits your eye? Like, I mean, you just played so good there. Like, what was it about that course?
I did. I guess first off and foremost, I just accepted the atmosphere and just loved the crowd. Loved 16, loved all the people. I mean, I used to, when I had an afternoon tea time, I'd take the long way to the range and walk through the
little hospitality,
the hospitality area there, just to look at people.
I did it too. I loved it.
Yeah. Exactly. Right.
Like going through a
nice
rock
day. I said, let's go sightsee a little bit. I mean, I just took it all in. As far as the golf course goes, it was home. I had tons of friends out there. Every year, the Thunderbirds gave me 200 tickets, and I used every one of them. And sure enough, they came out and cheered for me. One year, we had a T-shirt thing going called the Calcaholics. so, and of course, they were all drunk out there. I mean, it was it was just a fun event. And, you know, as you know, Willie and Jim, when you're having fun playing golf, you usually play better.
Absolutely.
You know, everybody says, well, why don't you have some fun? I said, well, when you're missing a 3-footer every other hole, it's pretty hard to have fun. But you know, so it's a fine line. But my attitude was always great there. I think as far as the golf course goes, it, you know, it's a second shot course. Mm-hmm. And if you short side yourself, you're generally in trouble. But I had an amazing short game. I could hit the high soft bunker shot. I could hit the flop shot, and I could read the greens. And I think all those factors combined just made it great for me.
Yeah, that tournament, the drunkest person I ever saw at a PGA Tour event was a female on Tuesday afternoon, and she had the highest heels I've ever seen, and she was walking like a baby deer, and she couldn't stand up, and I was like, okay, this event is incredible. I was like, why are these people this trashed on Tuesday?
Yeah, exactly. They get 30,000 people out there for the Monday Pro-Am, for crying out loud. It's incredible.
Yeah,
it's an event. It's like a happening. You know, it's like you're not cool unless you're singing at the Open.
Event in their social calendar. It's amazing.
It is a social event, and it's the most happening thing in Phoenix all year. It really is.
Yeah, it's tough to get into the parking lot and get out. The years that I played, they gave you big old trucks, and that parking lot is not big enough to be backing out some, you know, extended cab truck.
When you win, you get your own parking spot right up front. So,
oh, beautiful. So you didn't have any worries back
then. No, I didn't have to worry about any of that crap.
Front and center.
Yep. Right there in front of, right dead front and center. Yeah.
That's so cool. well, I mean, you know, we took a lot of your time tonight, and you know, you were just awesome guest. I hope you enjoyed it. I sure as heck did. This was just a badass conversation, and I just can't thank you enough, dude.
Anytime, yeah, brother. Yeah,
that was awesome, man.
Yep. Anytime, guys. Enjoyed it. It's especially at my age now, it's fun to talk about the old times, and I think about them a lot. So. Hopefully I'm still plugging away and going to play some in the next year or two and see what I got. If not, we'll just quietly phase on out. And it's been an amazing career. I've been very lucky.
Yeah, and you played through 3 decades and saw the game morph into such a massive sport over that time. And like, I mean, it had to just, obviously when the Tiger effect occurred in 97, the game got big. I mean, just the crowds had to be nuts. And just for every year, you had to just be amazed at how much more popularity came into the game.
Oh, I remember pretty much decade to decade. I remember the Western Open one year. It was other than the majors, our biggest money tournament of the year. It was $400,000 total purse. Oh, and I think I finished 16th and made like $3,800. And I was so excited that I played good in a big money tournament. And then I remember when Vegas was our first $1 million event, total purse. And everybody's like, can you believe we're playing for $1 million? And then, you know, of course it kept going up, and then Tiger and his effect. It's been incredible. It really is. And now what the guys are playing for, I don't think professional golfers are overpaid by any stretch when, you know, a guy standing out there in right field gets $160 million for 6 years, catching fly balls and batting 250. Mm-hmm. I mean, we earn our living.
Yeah,
if you miss a cut, you don't make squat, you know, and a lot of these guys have endorsements, but 90% of us don't. And, you have to earn your living, and you have to play well to make money. And I think we earn our money.
And you earned 1,000 starts. Wow. That is so cool. I'll be rooting for you really hard. And maybe when you win, you can come back on and we can reminisce some more and talk about your most recent success. I'd love to see you win. Do you have 4 wins on the Champions?
Yep, 4.
Yeah. Well, I hope you get number 5 this year, and I hope your back's on the mend. I'm sure it is. And I'm sure you're, you know, starting to get a little more distance behind it. I hope your driver search goes well. And just keep being a legend. And this was by far the coolest episode. I mean, not against anybody else that we've had, but I mean, to have Mark Kalkovec on is truly special. So this is you were one of my favorite players as a kid, and now to be able to talk to you like this has been really cool. So we really appreciate it, and yeah, I guess you can log out, and we are done with Tier Time episode 6.
Right on, guys. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark, and good luck in your tournament. Go win the 1,000 start. That'd be something.
That would be pretty cool.
That would be cool. So go out there and get them, buddy.
You got it.
Thanks, Cal.
All right, see you guys anytime.
See ya. That concludes episode 6 of Tier Time with Jim Renner and Willie Wilcox, me. And Mark Kalkvecchia was absolutely incredible. It was so cool to talk to a major champion. I hope you guys enjoyed it. And we're going to continue to try to get guys of that status and just legendary players in the game and just keep pumping out good content. So I hope you enjoyed the episode. It was just an absolute treat for us. It went by too quickly. I wish Mark was still on the air with us right now. But thank you for tuning in, and stay tuned.